Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. You will enjoy today's show. I interview Dr. Rennie. She is a U.S.-born and trained pediatrician whose family fled communism. She's been a clinical associate professor of medicine, taught over 1,000 residents and medical students, and her message is that we have an alarming loss of our freedoms. Here's a pediatrician who's been strongly pro-vaccine for her entire career, and now, after the COVID-19 vaccines, she's questioning this. She is questioning the regulatory agencies, big pharma, big tech, and she's now strongly against vaccine mandates. In fact, she lost her job due to vaccine mandates, and she's seen peers lose their jobs. She herself was disappeared, her word, from a classroom due to the inability to just simply talk about what was going on. This is about informed consent, folks. She's concerned about the mental health of our children, and she will be telling us her recommendations for what to do with kids. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My message today is question everything. You know, I don't spend much time sitting in front of the television. Almost never do I sit there and watch the news. I do catch it every once in a while, and I hear about it. Here's what's happening. We are being sold fear. That's what they're selling. You see, if they can keep us fearful, they can control us. So if we're going to start questioning everything, and I just beg you to really wake up to the importance of this, because what they're selling is fear of COVID. Oh, fear of a new variant. Wait a minute. There's monkeypox now. Oh, that's not working. We're going to change the name of monkeypox. That's coming, if you haven't heard that. Wait a minute. We just found polio in the sewage in New York. We're going to have a huge outbreak of polio. We need to go back and re-up all our vaccinations against polio. Folks, it was the flush toilet that got rid of polio. Anyway, point is, fear, fear, fear. Keep you afraid. It's not just bad for your health and your emotional well-being. It's bad for your immune system. So my heart aches for all of us, the public, the parents who are trying to do right by their kids, that they're being misled. So question everything. One of my nurses came into my office today, Dr. Thomas, what should we do with this? And she showed me a little message that came through our office. They want to offer us screenshots because there's a call to boycott Dr. Thomas. That's right, boycott me. Folks, I take that as a badge of honor. I must be doing something right. If the establishment out there is trying to censor me, which they have been, they're trying to boycott me. You know, if you are so threatening to the establishment, you're probably onto something important that they don't want you to know. So I'm glad you're here, that we're together. And I'm also really excited about another thing I'm going to share with you. Growing numbers of pediatricians. Yes, pediatricians are reaching out to me. You're going to see several of them on our show in the coming months and weeks. And they also are waking up as they start to question when they realize, wow, the CDC is bold-faced lying about so much when it comes to COVID. I wonder what else they might have been lying to us about. And so you start having brand new converts to the importance of informed consent, that you get the full story and you only get there if you question. So question everything. It's on us to do that. And I want to end with this. It's all about love. It's all about trust. Who do you trust? Well, I ask you, I urge you, trust yourself. I call them the mama bear, papa bear, if you're a parent. Your intuition, your gut sense of, is this right for my child? And if something isn't sitting right, don't rush forward and do something that you might later regret. So trust your own instinct, your own sense of right and wrong, and do your research. Ending with love, I'm Dr. Paul. Dr. Paul here, coming to you off the cuff. This is a segment I do primarily for members, but the beginning of this segment, I want all viewers to have access to this because, well, for a couple reasons. One is I want you to go to doctorsandscience.com. And right there at the very top bar is Vaxxed Unvaxxed. Click on that. That gets you to a major presentation I gave this past year, as well as the actual data from my study, the primary main graphs that are so vital. This is easy to share with your loved ones, people you care about. They can go to doctorsandscience.com, and right there they just, bam, click on the Vaxxed Unvaxxed data. You see, That's been the problem with our research. The research is one vaccine at a time, short duration of trials, funded by pharma, manipulated data by pharma. They exclude what they want, they include what they want. When they analyze the data, they get the outcomes they want. They set the study and the trials up to get what they want, which is always going to be to show something positive about your product because you're into this business of selling products. What we have not had until just the last few years are good studies that look at the entire vaccine schedule. Kids who have been subjected to that, compare them to kids who have not been vaccinated at all. That's the real standard, right? The control group, as they say. Well, I present the data from multiple different studies, including my own. And once you see this data, folks, it is like a aha moment. It's a wake up. Wow, how come nobody ever told me this? So that's now free. Everybody, you don't have to be a member to get access to that data, and I wanted that data free. Now, what I want to share with you is that there are other things, other benefits to becoming a member. I'll be honest, doing what I'm doing, doing this show, we have no corporate sponsors. Pharma, yeah, I should ask them, hey, you want to sponsor this show? I'm exposing everything. We're just going for the data, the truth. Of course not. Big industry, big pharma, they do not want independent outlets such as Against the Wind sharing truths, sharing data, sharing information that's unfortunately inconvenient for them because it doesn't follow their narrative, right? The healthcare system, or I'd like to call it the sick care system in this country, is about diagnose and treat, and the treatments are all pharmaceutical. If you have a natural treatment, boy, we sure saw this with COVID. We discovered very early on, I published a book in April of 2020 on COVID and what the media won't tell you. And it talked about the importance of things like melatonin, zinc, vitamin C, vitamin D. You can't patent that stuff, right? And so there's no market for massive profits. And so the profits and the diagnose and treat sick care system that we have always steers you towards pharmaceutical products. And that's really not what wellness is all about. Here's why you should become a member. You will get exclusive information from me, things that are made easy to find. Everything that's free is also available there, of course, to members, but there's a whole lot more. So we're gonna have my favorite Substacks listed for you right there. That's something you can go to. There's another benefit for many of you who are watching this, and then now you're gonna wanna become a member. The benefit is this: we have each other's emails. We can communicate securely and we can stay in touch. Things are happening in my world to where you may need to get in touch with me. I may need to get in touch with you. That's a secure way to do it. Now there is a tiny cost, $4.95. I wish I could just give it all away, everything, but I have to produce this show. I have to pay the producers, I have the editors, the filming crew. There's actually a cost. So far, I'm not making profit from this show. I just want to get this information out, but we need to support the production. So it's $4.95, a good cup of coffee per month. And think of that actually as a donation. Yes, you're going to get some amazing benefits, but you're also supporting our work. And I admire that more than anything. So go to Doctors in Science, become a member, become part of our team, become part of our family. There's going to be a lot more important things coming down the road very soon that you're going to want to know about. It will be exclusive to members, people whose emails I have, so that I can communicate with you. Patients, if you happen to be a patient of mine and you're watching, this includes you especially. You should have another way of getting a hold of me. All right. Now, on to my members-only exclusive content. I want to share with you my journey, where we're at today. This week, it's crazy. So here's my world. And I only share this because the things I do are being monitored very heavily by... Welcome, Dr. Rennie Moon. It is such a privilege to have you on Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I had not known about you till very recently. You are U.S. trained. You're a pediatrician, 20 years of hospital and clinic work. You have an interesting background. Your family fled communism, and we're definitely going to get into that. You were born in the USA. I was too. I actually grew up in Africa, so I understand that, you know, having a different cultural background.
You've been an advocate for traditional childhood vaccines. You don't consider yourself anti-vax. We share another thing in common. You're a clinical associate professor of medicine. I did that as well in the earlier part of my career. You've taught thousands of medical students, residents, interns. I did as well. It's such an amazing experience, right, to be in that role of mentoring and teaching. And now you're speaking out about what you're concerned, as I am, the loss of freedoms that we're all experiencing with what's going on. But maybe just start off, and I need to get to know you better, and our audience needs to get to know you. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so my family fled from communism. My dad was born in Buenos Aires. My mom was born in Prague. And they found themselves, you know, back behind the Iron Curtain, which for the listener was a huge electric, you know, watchtower, barbed wire fence that basically kept them prisoner within their own countries. And so I grew up with the knowledge that they had fled from communism, and that I was very, very fortunate to have been born right here in America, where we have freedom. But I didn't really, I don't think, appreciate what that meant much until I was an adult. I went to visit my grandparents for the first time. I'd seen them previously. They were allowed to travel here because they were older, so they allowed them to travel to the U.S. So they had seen me when I was little. But my first visit to my parents, former, you know, to their homeland, was when I was 11. And I'll just never forget the train pulling into the Iron Curtain and the watchtowers and the guards with their submachine guns and German Shepherd dogs.
This was at the country's border?
Right at the border of the country. And it really put a very odd perspective on going to visit grandparents and relatives, right? Because they really were prisoners in their own country. Yeah. And couldn't leave without special government permission. And the government would never allow an entire family to leave together, or even a younger married couple, because they were concerned that they wouldn't come back. Most of them would not come back to that situation. So I remember visiting relatives that way. And it was pretty eye-opening, you know, watching or listening to propaganda. And I didn't fully appreciate it for what it was as a kid. But what I do remember is listening to the voice of America. So my countrymen, America, was piping in the real news to my relatives. And my grandmother would listen to the radio with the voice of America, which in that country was called Hlas Ameriki, voice of America. But she had to do it very quietly. She would whisper at me and say, shh, because the walls were really thin. And if the neighbors heard her listening to this truth being piped in by another nation, then, you know, she would be in big trouble. So, you know, I was so proud of America and the fact that we were sending the truth to my relatives and the fact that we were free.
Yeah. So I share that exact sentiment. At least that's how I used to feel about our media. Uh-huh. And, you know, we'll probably chat some more about what's happened to our once freer media. Certainly COVID has pulled the wool off of many of our eyes to the extent to which our own media here in what we consider a very free country has been bought and paid for and is also now, to some extent, propaganda.
I wouldn't even say to some extent. We are full on propaganda at this point. I began to see it maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Yeah. At least in the mainstream channels. Yeah.
No, I couldn't agree more. Probably with your background and having seen it at such an intense level, right, in the communist world back then. Yeah. How do you feel about what you're seeing right now here in the United States?
I'm horrified. You know, we have to remember history and how many millions of people have fled to America for freedom. I think what I like to think about, because it puts it into perspective, is to have the listener think about what would it take for you to leave your entire family behind everything that you've worked so hard for, your possessions, your house, your grandparents, your parents, your aunts and uncles, to leave them, to go to a nation where you don't really speak the language fluently, where you have a couple dollars in your pocket. What kind of atrocities were they leaving to do that? That's what millions upon millions of people have come to America for. They've come for freedom. And my family, when they came, had no one here. They applied for, they were vetted. They had to apply to the different countries to show that they would, be citizens who would assimilate and love their new nation. So they filled out applications. They had to apply to Canada, to America, to Australia, and they had to wait until those applications were processed. That's the kind of immigration policy that makes sense.
So many amazing stories. It's great to hear them and be reminded. I think I went through medical school and residency in pediatrics about maybe 15 years ahead of you. But I'm interested in your journey. What was that like, just with your background and understanding of the world and then becoming a pediatrician? And then, you know, just take a short journey there and to now, the last 2-3 years with COVID, what's happened?
Well, I was always taught by my parents that America was awesome. You work hard and you can become whoever you want to become, but you have to put the effort in. So I worked hard and was accepted to one of the top schools in the nation and went there, worked really hard, earned a degree in biochemistry, and then was accepted to a number of medical schools and was very lucky. I had a choice of med schools and I loved it. It's great. Great training, great people. We had just wonderful discussions. I remember classes where, you know, they didn't tell you how to think necessarily. I mean, obviously in med school, you have to learn certain procedures and skills and things like that. But as far as the debate part of things or the dialogue discussion parts of things, we were taught to think. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily how to think. So we were given so many different viewpoints to consider, had discussions about those. And you ultimately, you know, one professor you might agree with, another one you might not. That was fine. You ultimately found where your own, you know, where your own compass sort of is. But most importantly, we learned to listen to the patient and to make sure you understood their story and to help them with their journey, with their medical journey as best you could.
You sound like you had an ideal training. Mine was similar, very open back then. I feel like the kids going through med school today and residency are having a different experience. Since you've been teaching, maybe you can speak to that some. What made you choose pediatrics?
Once you're in medical school, you can pick pretty much what you want.
Sure.
You know, as long as they accept you to the training programs. But as you know, but yeah, I never deviated from pediatrics at all. You know, we would go like on OBGYN rotations and I'd help deliver a baby. And then I really honestly just cared about how the baby, I mean, obviously I wanted the mom to do well too, but I didn't want to be involved necessarily as much in her care as I did the baby. The baby was the draw to me. So yeah,
a natural pediatrician.
And what I love about the kids is they're just so brutally honest especially when they're little. I just think they're hysterically funny, you know. Yeah. And so there isn't a day in clinic that I don't think is fun. And so
we have the best job, honestly. It's a lovely career. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit maybe about your experience in teaching. So I'm interested because I think you've taught more recently than I have. I did for the first 6 years of my career, and then I had a huge family. So to support them, I had to go into private practice and teaching just didn't pay.
Yeah.
As you probably know, but talk to me a little bit about what that's been like and how you've seen changes in that world.
Yeah. So my entire career, I've taught in some way. I've always had residents or medical students, with me. I've had affiliations with three different medical schools over the course of my career. And so I do want to just be careful and say that I'm not going to specifically discuss any one particular medical school because I have had some very concerning experiences these last few years. but I'm not going to label any one medical school with those. So let's just say they happened and they are happening nationwide. And so I think the focus should be on the fact that these situations are not unique to me. But I love teaching. I love that, you know, I was a resident once, I was a medical student once, we all were. And so we pay back. And the majority of the teaching that I've done during my career, like for most of us, has been free of charge, meaning I don't get a salary that's anything different for having taught than for not having taught. But I have noticed some huge changes from the time I started to teach until now. And the changes have really happened, I would say, over the last maybe 4 or 5 years, somewhere in that time frame. And that's that our students and residents are they've come from a different high school background. I think that's where it stems from, many of them, and a different kind of societal background. And I'm not going to tiptoe around it. Many of them are very much, you know, they're very much part of the woke terminology that we're seeing across society. And that's fine. That's their freedom of speech and that's their opinion. And that's fine. But I think many faculty are finding that the students are pretty intolerant to anyone else having a different perspective on things. And that makes it hard because in the teaching world, as we talked about earlier, you know, we do want students to hear about a variety of different perspectives. Their patients will come to them with a variety of different needs and viewpoints and situations in their lives. And so we want students who have really thought through the details of the different, you know, perspectives that are out there. And so, but faculty have increasingly had to be very careful about what they do or don't say in front of the students because, you know, frankly, we're being reported to administration. Students are increasingly using words like traumatized and harmed if they hear words that are different from what their own narrative is. And, you know, obviously, we don't have the freedom to belittle somebody or to yell at them or to be, you know, horrible to them. I have tried very hard in my career to never do that. I, you know, obviously there are some students that don't like you and that's just the way life is. But by and large, my evaluations from students have been good. And you know, it's been, I haven't had any issues, but I did have an issue last year. And so what happened was our school picks the one of the schools where I've been affiliated picks the topic for discussion with the students. And the topic that day was racism. So obviously a very...
That's a tricky one.
And I knew going into that discussion that day that I needed to be very, very careful. And that's fine. I come from, again, a family with connections to really 3 different continents. I speak 3 languages. I am not the least bit racist. This is not about that. This is about just having a discussion about racism and how it would affect our patients and all that. So the students had a discussion and I was there to moderate. And interestingly, as we neared the end of that discussion and I had stayed fairly silent, it occurred to me they had not even once mentioned Martin Luther King. Well, Martin Luther King, as we all know, has been a very important influence on American culture and American viewpoints. And I thought that there should be some mention of his, you know, his viewpoints.
His contributions.
So I pretty much paraphrased Martin Luther King. And, you know, I said something to the effect that, you know, there's a different perspective out there for us to consider. And that's that, you know, everyone has a skin color. Some are more pink, some are more brown, some are more black, some are more yellow. And this perspective is that the skin color that we have really shouldn't matter. What matters is the content of our actions and our character and our behavior. So I paraphrased him. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much more about it because that's something my professors would have done. And we would have certainly not avoided the topic at all. Well, it came back to bite me a little bit later. I was called into my chairman's office and told that students had complained that I had caused them trauma and harm. with having shared that perspective. And there were some other complaints against me. One of them was a complaint that during a time when we were socializing, just as the COVID-19 vaccine was rolling out, they asked me what I thought about it. Now, we were socializing. I wasn't lecturing about the vaccine. I didn't actually know much about it at that point. But I said to them, I talked to them like I would a colleague. I said, you know, I've been burned before by new technology. So I think it's really slick technology and I hope it works. But I'm worried about, you know, and I threw out some critical thinking type thoughts. I said, I'm worried about the biodistribution of this. I'm worried about, you know, could it cause rheumatologic effects or immune effects? Where does it go in the body? You know, I just threw out some thoughts and honestly, I didn't think that much of it. They asked me and I told them, well, that turned into a complaint against me as well. The students complained to the chairman that I had caused them trauma and harm. There's those words again, trauma and harm. Now differing perspectives now apparently cause trauma and harm. And the trauma and harm was that I had told them that I was worried that the technology might not be 100% safe. Well, nothing is 100% safe. Driving a car is not 100% safe. An aspirin is not 100% safe. So we are in a very dangerous, I think, situation nationwide. I don't just think it. I know it. I've seen it firsthand. That we are being silenced and kept from having complete discussions with students because they expect certain narratives. And if they don't hear them, that it turns rapidly into trauma and harm to them if it's a differing perspective. And that's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, those catchwords can then be used to somehow validate that they're right because they were harmed.
You know, we all want to get rid of racism. I mean, it's a horrible thing. You know, sexism. I've dealt with sexism during my entire career. I am white, but I'm a female in medicine. And so I've weekly would see issues related to sexism, especially in a hospital setting where people didn't pick me as their doctor. They were randomly assigned a female doctor. And so it comes out. So these are all conversations absolutely worth having. But if you disappear your professor from the classroom for even bringing it up, then we go nowhere and we don't have those conversations. And that's the struggle that I think our nation is facing right now is that, you know, what I'm concerned about is looking again at history. These are the same things my mom saw happen when she was in college. She saw professors, you know, disappeared for having differing perspectives. We've seen that through, you know, if you look at the history of Chairman Mao in the Asian world, this is what happened in the years preceding his reign. You know, professors being disappeared without anything. And so I ultimately was investigated for concerns of student mistreatment because bringing up differing perspectives somehow must have been mistreatment of students. And it really, you know, that's not the point of today's dialogue, but it really took on a whole different perspective and really quite terrifying, really, when you think about the fact that, you know, I love my students. I think that they're great people. I want the best for them. And right now they're not getting the best education if their faculty is fearful of, you know, bringing up these perspectives. And
So you feel like you were disappeared.
Oh, I was absolutely disappeared. And, you know, I never saw those students again. There was never any sort of a sit down, let's have a dialogue and figure out what went wrong. The students who had not complained about me were also never interviewed, actually. And so I had students reaching out to me. They thought I'd had a health issue. They were like, are you okay? And I couldn't respond to them back by email because I had been told not to communicate with the students at all. A gag order, essentially. And so to this day, I've never seen them again. So I really was literally disappeared from teaching for that period of time.
Cancel culture at its best.
Mm-hmm. I don't even have words for it except for that we have to fix it because this is not something that we can continue to do in terms of teaching our students. We're hearing this play out in law schools. We're seeing this play out across the nation in college campuses and in obviously in other medical schools. This is all coming to light. It's all bubbling to the surface, and we need to get this fixed.
Wow, that's incredible. Can you speak to what's happened with this whole issue of informed consent? You know, my whole reason for being the way I am is honoring informed consent. I had to leave my old group practice because they wouldn't honor informed consent when it came to vaccines. I was just saying, you know, present all the data, present the benefits, the risks, the alternatives. One of the alternatives has to be not doing them. I mean, otherwise it's not informed choice. It's an, you know, it's mandates. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience with informed consent?
I'm really worried about it for the same reasons that you just mentioned. Informed consent is a foundation of medicine. If you, as a physician, cannot give a patient informed consent, and by that I really mean informed, you need to let them know what the basic risks are with any procedure or anything that you're about to recommend, and you have to give them, I mean, they have to give consent. And by consent, we mean it cannot be coerced, forced. You can't threaten them or bully them into something. Otherwise, it's not consent, right? So informed consent, those words, those two words are massive in the medical world. Those are so important because then we get into, you know, we get into really ugly places ethically if that's not happening. And so I've seen that crumble. And yeah, I've seen that crumble. And I will add that just recently, this is something that your listeners may not have heard of yet, because I've only learned of it myself and it hasn't hit the national scene as much yet. But we actually now have physicians nationwide who have been fired from their positions for giving informed consent to their patients. Yeah. And the one letter that one of the physicians sent to me, so I asked to see it in writing. Everything I'm saying today is something I have personally witnessed or seen. I don't, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors out there right now. So everything I say, I've seen. She sent me a letter that came from an employer that ended up firing her over the informed consent issue. But before they fired her, they basically sent her a letter that said something to the effect of, you need to modify your behaviors to conform with what our clinic is asking you to do. And that is to use the words safe and effective. And that's it.
Wow.
And so the informed consent completely out the window. Physicians now starting to be fired over it. And I know other people, it sounds like you left over it. I don't know if you were fired over the informed consent issue or if you left over it. Plenty of reason to leave over it. How sure. can we be asked to do this?
Yeah. So my story was in 2007, I saw my fourth case of a kid regressing into severe autism. And I just went to my partners and said, I can't justify the hepatitis B for newborns whose mothers are Hep B negative and who don't themselves have Hep B. And they said it's unethical not to follow the complete CDC schedule. And we disagreed. So we had a divorce. Mm-hmm. More recently, you probably heard my story. Basically, over the informed consent issue, the medical board took my license on an emergency basis. Mm-hmm. So since I wasn't employed anymore by anyone who could discipline me, the only hammer, so to speak, is the medical board. And boy, they come down heavy. It's tragic. Patients are not aware that they're not getting informed consent. So actually, just for I think it's important for people listening to hear this. Let's talk about COVID and how did informed consent look to you in the beginning? Because obviously in the beginning, none of us knew anything. And then if it's real informed consent, you're giving accurate information, which I don't think people are getting anymore about COVID. Certainly if all you get is news anchors reports, you're getting safe and effective mantra. And that's just a marketing slogan. But what's been your experience with how did COVID change things for you?
Again, I've been pro-vaccine my entire career. I've been pro-traditional vaccines. I have supported my patients who have chosen not to vaccinate. And we've had conversations around that. But, you know, I've been pro-vaccine. And when the COVID pandemic was hitting in March of 2020, I think, you know, we all remember those days. And you know, you're in the same field, so you know, I was pretty sure we were all going to die from this thing, because here it was, this horrible virus coming our way. And if you've followed a pediatrician around, you know that we're covered in coughs and sneezes and all sorts of things that I won't say on air, you know, by the end of our workday. So we're not going to stay, you know, safe from this. So I was pretty sure we were all goners. And, you know, I don't mean to downplay this virus. It really, truly has been an awful virus for some vulnerable members of our population. But I began to really crunch numbers, like as we all did. And it became clear to me really early on that, you know, within a few months, that what really mattered was the denominator on this thing, meaning what really mattered was how many people out there had this virus and were fine with it. And that was how we calculate our infection fatality rate. And it actually wasn't as bad as, you know, as I had initially thought it might be. And again, I'm not trying to negate people. My own family members I've had in the hospital with COVID and have been quite ill, who are older adults. So it certainly can be awful for some members of society, but for our kids, they were fine. They were good. I saw hundreds of kids in my office that had COVID and were absolutely fine. And as we've looked at the data with fatalities from COVID in the pediatric population, thankfully it's been very, very, very small. And so generally speaking, your otherwise healthy child with COVID has basically a 0% chance of death from COVID. It's, you know, they might be hospitalized for dehydration. We see that every year with kids with any virus. They might be hospitalized, you know, for a shorter period of time with something, but even that is very unlikely, you know, statistically. So as this was rolling out, I was definitely watching to see, and the vaccine was coming out, and it initially, as you know, wasn't available for kids until a bit later. I actually took a stand against the mandate first, because my family fled from a nation in which they were politically persecuted and where they had to show their papers, right? They had to show their papers. And so when my employer wanted me to show my papers and basically told me I had to get this vaccine, I'm going to call it a vaccine. I think obviously but it's just simpler to keep that terminology right now. I said, no, I said, this is my personal medical information. I'm doing this to support my families that choose to vaccinate, that choose not to vaccinate, as much as I'm choosing it for my own freedom. I will not comply with this mandate. And so I refused to turn in my vaccine record because, again, my family fled from a place where they had to show their papers. And we're in America. We do not do that here. We have freedom.
Yeah. It reminds me of apartheid. I grew up in Southern Africa. And if you were the wrong color in Southern Africa, in South Africa specifically, you could not move about freely. You had to show your papers. To go to certain parts of the country. You know, that was the apartheid system, and now we're going to have that here in the US.
I actually just didn't turn my papers in to my employer, because at that point we knew that this vaccine does not stop transmission. And even if it did, I obviously think that you don't have the right to tell anyone what risks they do or don't have to take with their body. But this doesn't stop transmission. Our CDC director has said as much, doesn't stop the spread. And so I was ready with a letter. Ultimately the deadline came and went. And within a half hour, I had an email. They pulled me from a fully booked clinic, perfectly healthy physician. I was booked for 3 or 4 weeks out. They pulled me from my clinic. They said, don't bother to come tomorrow until you give us your vaccine record. And I said, well, that's not going to happen. So they gave me a couple months leave of absence, unpaid, to think it over. I don't have anything to think over. I'm quite firm. I could have done a religious exemption. I could not have done a medical exemption. They don't not accepting any of those.
Right.
But I went for the third option, which is, as a human being, I have constitutional rights. I have basic human rights, and I'm doing this for everybody else as well. I'm drawing a line in the sand. I'm not turning in any religious exemption for this, and I will not comply. And so that was my last day in clinic. I didn't see my patients. They don't know where I went. I disappeared. I was disappeared from clinic. They are very wrong. They're on the wrong side of history with this. And that's, you know, my letter spelled it out for them, and they ultimately fired me. So. Wow.
So, I mean, this is at a huge financial and career cost to you. Yeah. How have you pivoted from that huge loss? I mean, you're still young. Mm-hmm. It's not like you know, in medicine, it's not like you have a plan B.
So they don't have, you know, these administrators and the government officials, they don't have my skills. They don't have my knowledge set. If they really, truly want to disappear, fully experienced, top U.S. trained physician with no past record of anything, then I wonder how concerned they are about our physician shortage during a pandemic. I am double board certified. I'm board certified in pediatric hospital medicine. I'm general pediatric certified. If I lose my entire career over this, and I love my career, I love taking care of patients. If I lose my entire career over this, and at the end of the day, we in America are free again, then it is 100% worth it. I will find some other job if that's what it happens. But, you know, we have to fight this. This is very, very wrong.
I couldn't agree more. There is a number of us who are in the medical freedom world who understand that the system we currently were working under is so broken that we probably cannot fix it from the inside. And with your set of credentials and your experience, I can see you heading up a parallel hospital or a pediatric ward in a hospital that's free from regulation. It's coming. Hang in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I know. We're not done yet. We're nope. we are just starting, but the listeners should know, if they don't already, that the medical world is under a full assault. We're under a complete assault. This is a massive war against your freedom, against your ability to choose your healthcare, against your freedom in general. And there are a lot of physicians fighting for all of us. And so we're not anywhere close to being done yet. We are just getting started. There are new physicians joining us every day in this who are waking up and seeing what's happening. And, but we have to draw a line in the sand, and we have to say no. And this is like some sort of Orwellian nightmare, right? Like every day I'm like, is this really happening? You know, every day I'm like, oh, let's just add to the joy of the crazy that's happening here. Like, who could even make this up?
Since we're both pediatricians, I'd love to hear your perspective on what has happened to our children as a result of masking, social distancing, all of the countermeasures, if you will, that were put in place by public health officials. What's that done to our kids?
My state was on the front lines. I was in Washington State and very much on the front lines of what's happening here. So there are many states, I think, in the U.S. that haven't quite seen the horror that we've seen, but I've had a front row seat to a lot of different things as we've talked about today. And one of those front row seats is to the mental health of our nation's children. So to be really clear, their mental health was not great already, like starting back in about 2013 or 2014. I blame social media and, you know, smartphones and all the technology these kids used to bully one another and just to really have a hard time. But our emergency rooms were already filling up with kids who were in need of psychiatric services. I want to just quickly contrast that to when I first started practice back in like the late 1990s, early 2000s. I didn't even know who my child psychiatrist was in my busy practice, because I maybe sent one kid a year, maybe two kids a year. I'd have to go look up the name of who am I referring you to? Contrast that to now, where literally like every day, several kids being referred to psychiatry, you know, colleagues of mine saying, we need more psychiatrists. We need more psychiatrists. And I don't disagree. We absolutely do, but we need to figure out and cut the pipeline of what's causing our nation's kids' mental health to just, it's just gone to pieces. So this all started in 2013, 2014, but then the pandemic hit and I had a front row seat to this nightmare. So many kids coming into the office. I would say I had, at that point, I was office-based, primarily, still hospital, but primarily office-based. And sometimes 5, 6, 7 a day, mm-hmm. a day with their hair in their face. They can't give me a straight answer. Depressed, anxious, cutting themselves, suicidal, just their mental health is in the toilet. They can't tell me, you know, what they want to do when they grow up. They have just no hopes, no dreams for their future. Now, of course, there's some kids that are still functioning through this, but what we did to the kids with the distancing and the masking and the isolation and the, we did things to them that we don't do to prisoners of war because it's illegal. And we did stuff to them. I had kids coming into the office that had literally not left their house. We were like a year and a half into this pandemic and they had not left their house because they were afraid that they would get COVID from their backyard, from the fresh air outside. They were sitting in front of me, just visibly shaking. And I just walk in, I say, what's going on? And they just said, this is the first time I've been out of my house in like a year and a half, but I'm so anxious. I had to come see you. And I just can't even, I had days where I drove home crying. The mental health of our nation's kids, we have to all fix that. And what I would beg the listener today to reach out to some kids around you, get them into activities that are fun with one another, get them socializing, get them a normal life again. You know, these are all things that everyone listening can do. Find kids around you and help them. Because what we've done is just been, you know, and again, early on, we didn't know what this virus was and we didn't know what the risk was to kids. So distancing and isolating made sense early on, but then we stopped physicians and other people from being allowed to even debate and discuss what the next best steps were. And so as we had the data, that should have been fixed.
Yeah. And the data that we now know, and I'm just going to ask you if you agree, masking doesn't do anything really. It's not helping prevent infections. If anything, it might be making things worse. Yeah. And it was all unnecessary, certainly for children. I heard similar stories like, I don't want to leave the house because I might get COVID and then get grandma sick.
Yeah.
I'll kill my grandma. And putting that sort of guilt on a little kid, it's tragic.
Yeah, we put fear and we put guilt on them, you know, for just living. And yeah, if you've ever seen a child wear a mask, I think you've seen a child wear a mask and, you know, they're touching their faces, they're touching the surfaces around them, they're touching each other. The virus doesn't just stop and not come out of you because you have a mask on.
Right.
This is, you know, but what scares me is these kids now have, many of them, the younger ones, have spent such a large percentage of their life wearing a mask that they're actually afraid to take it off.
I've experienced the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's hard to watch that because, again, you know, this is not preventing anything to have a mask on. Now, do we want a child to bring home a virus to a grandparent? You know, that's a higher risk. Of course not. No one wants to do that, but that can be handled more sensibly with hand washing and staying away when you're not feeling well. Every family can, you know, there's different things we can do with that don't cause this kind of trauma and harm. And imagine being a six-year-old who's grown up with this fear of this unknown tiny virus. They don't even know what a virus is. They can't see it. They can't smell it. They can't taste it. It's just this mysterious, scary thing that's somehow around you. They've grown up with that fear. And fear is how they take our freedom away. We will give our freedom away if we're fearful. And as a nation, we've been so fearful that we have let our freedom just poof, go away.
My goodness, I agree with you. We've got to get kids outdoors. We've got to get masks off their faces. We got to get them back to school. If you want to school your kid, that's another whole topic, which we probably won't touch on today. So In your journey as a pediatrician and understanding vaccines and the risks and benefits and all that, has this COVID situation caused you to kind of take a second look at the whole childhood vaccine schedule at all?
Yeah, I haven't had time to look into it in great detail. I think it is clear to me, having watched the, you know, we trusted my colleagues, you, my other colleagues, we all trusted the system for some period of time. Now, we had different points where we realized what's happening, but we've all trusted it. We have listened to what is coming down to us from the regulatory agencies. We were taught, I was taught to go back and look at the ultimate source and the data and all that. But the reality is we're busy people. We have busy practices. You don't have time to go back and look at the original research for much of what, you know, you recommend. And that is a huge problem, it turns out, when you are not getting accurate information from above. And so I watched the FDA hearings. I watched the committee hearings on all this.
For COVID for kids. Yeah.
I was screaming at my computer. I'm like, you don't have the data.
Right.
You don't have the data. And then, you know, but you're screaming at it one way and there's no way to get to the people that are issuing this. Well, then go back and look at that tape. I'm sure you know it and your listeners may have heard. They actually said, one of the voting members of the committee actually said, we don't have the data. Like, they admitted it. And then they said the most chilling words I think I've ever heard in my career, which was that we really won't know until we roll it out there, meaning to our kids.
We're going to experiment on our
kids. We're going to experiment on our kids, meaning we agreed that we don't have the data and then said we're going to roll it out there. And for kids, where is the emergency for our kids? Where is the emergency for our kids? We had more kids that died tragically from swine flu back in 2009, then we have, and that was just in one season, then we have from COVID and in several years of COVID. We have no proof that this stops those deaths. They're very, very few. Your child has basically a 0% chance of death from this COVID infection.
Right.
And yet, so where is the emergency? And then they're silencing us. They're asking us to actually be quiet and not express our concerns about what they're doing and to also not tell them about what we're seeing in terms of adverse reactions.
Yeah.
So you silence the frontline physicians who are supposed to be reporting on this. And then, of course, VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, that has just exploded with alarm signals. And we're supposed to ignore those.
Yeah, absolutely insane. Well, Dr. Rennie, you have already been canceled, so to speak. You've already had to deal with losing your position as a professor, with losing your major career track for standing on your principles. So I would rather hear from you than from somebody who's had to sell out their soul to stay in the system. So I think it's important for our audience to hear what you have to say. I mean, you're a pediatrician and you've been pro-vaccine. What are you going to tell parents today with what we know? Should they go out and get their 6-month-old, 5-year-old, 11-year-old, 16-year-old, for that matter, the COVID jab?
Yeah. So I give parents informed consent. That's what I'm supposed to do. So, and informed consent means we discuss the risks and we discuss the benefits. So what are the benefits as we know it today to giving your child this injection? Your child has basically a 0% chance of death from the infection. We have no proof that getting the injection will prevent the extremely remote possibility of hospitalization or death for your child. There's just no evidence for that. So that's the discussion that we have on the benefit side. Really, there is no benefit that we can see with today's data. What are the risks? I think we've all seen that there are risks to this. The CDC and their informational handout has a list of those risks and admit that children have developed, and I firsthand know of cases of myocarditis for kids after the vaccine. How high a risk is that? It's certainly not zero. Certainly higher than you have from having the infection, which it doesn't prevent. So, and myocarditis is inflammation of your heart, myo, muscle, carditis, heart. Having inflammation of your heart is not a good thing. I can think of maybe a handful of cases of myocarditis that I've seen in my entire 20 years of practice before the vaccine rolled out. Very, very rare. And I worked in a hospital setting for 15 years. I worked in the outpatient world for a chunk of time as well. I've seen so many kids in my career, and I can only think of a handful that had myocarditis before this rolled out. Now they're asking us to accept myocarditis as being just a normal, you know, childhood illness, and it's not. It has big dangers, and what the dangers will be for children long term with inflammation of their hearts from the vaccine, we don't know. We don't know, but we know that having inflammation of your heart can cause scarring. And if you have scarring of your heart, then that can predispose you to having a rhythm issue with your heart. So myocarditis is a risk. Other neurological issues are risks. So we've seen kids with neurological problems as a result of this. Guillain-Barré, transverse myelitis. There are other cases of neurological changes that we don't fully understand. Blood clots. So this is a risk-benefit decision that a parent has to make. The risks clearly are higher than any benefit at this point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Have you seen, or how many cases have you seen of myocarditis after the jab?
So I want to come back to other vaccines. So when the rotavirus vaccine first rolled out, our regulatory agencies pulled it from the market. We no longer gave it to patients because there were some cases of the bowel of your intestines telescoping into themselves.
Yeah.
And causes blockage into susception. And there was under 100 cases, somewhere around that, nationwide. Very, very few. I personally never saw, I mean, I've seen cases of into susception, but I didn't see it following the vaccine. I already know of too many cases of myocarditis. Now, some of them have been friends. They're not people I necessarily have cared for in the clinic, but because again, I was pulled from my clinic right as this vaccine was launching out.
Right.
Yes.
Right. But well, and your experience as a hospitalist would put you in touch with the sickest kids, and you would in that world see myocarditis. I, for example, only being a hospitalist for the first 5-6 years of my career, I've got 30 years in the trenches in the clinics. I had never seen a case of myocarditis until they rolled this COVID jab out.
That's now, right.
Get hospitalized for myocarditis already.
Right now, the huge concern is that we're causing all this risk for kids with this shot that's on top of the very small risk they have of the infection causing right. some of these issues. So, I do have several cases in friends who I have direct knowledge of their kids having, or their young adults in their early 20s having myocarditis. One of my friends, her son was just recently discharged from the military. He went in completely healthy. He developed chest pain and palpitations 5 days after his second dose of the injection and was diagnosed with myocarditis with an elevated troponin level. He just was discharged from the military on a medical discharge for myocarditis and high blood pressure.
How do we reach our peers? I feel like, you know, it's a breath of fresh air talking with you because you get it. Your eyes were opened. You're actually looking at the data and thinking. I feel like so many of our peers are not. What happened and how do we reach them?
I think they're still caught in that. I'm listening to my agencies and they're telling me the full truth and everyone else is crazy. Yeah, I think it's a tough one. I will say that I have many colleagues around the country that I've spoken to and I'm speaking to who absolutely do see it. There are many, many of us stepping up each day. We have more joining us and more joining together to fight this every single day. I do want to add one more thing, which I just wanted to make sure I said today, which is actually also concerning, is that as we give informed consent to patients, and we've actually had some patients who have also reported physicians for giving informed consent mm-hmm. back to the clinics again. So here are physicians trying to do the right thing. And we got parents, reporting them for telling them informed consent. But as my mom says, America, she loves America. She's been here since her 20s, but she says that the trouble is the average American has always had freedom and they've never had a reason to distrust their media.
Absolutely. So in closing, what are your favorite resources that you would have viewers and physicians consider looking at?
You know, I would have my physician colleagues first and foremost, look at VAERS. I can't even tell you how many physician colleagues, when I say, I'm worried about this vaccine, I'm worried about all the reports on VAERS. And I had a number of them say, what's VAERS?
Yes, I've had the same thing.
They don't even know what it is. Yeah. But I would have my physician colleagues look at VAERS. I would have them look at the many, many articles that people have written on websites such as the globalcovidsummit.org.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Folks, you can go to openvaers.org for a very easy summary of what's in VAERS. Robert Malone was, inventor of the mRNA technology. Peter McCullough, as you mentioned, he's a giant in his field of cardiology and his understanding of COVID. I think he's written more articles on COVID and been frontline treating it. So it's not like you're talking to some academic type position person like Fauci who doesn't treat patients, who's just spouting theory that is basically propaganda also because he's so conflicted financially. We have a ton of great resources and wow, you've been a joy to have on the show. If you have any closing thoughts, go right ahead and share them.
Well, I want to just quickly to mention Dr. Kirk Milhone, M-I-L-H-O-A-N. Has been very instrumental in speaking out. He is a pediatric cardiologist who actually has an MD and a PhD. His PhD is actually in, I believe his dissertation was on myocarditis actually back in the day, but you can find him also on globalcovidsummit.org. We are having a large medical freedom event where a lot of these speakers will be speaking. We'll have a whole day of pediatric sessions. But as Dr. McCullough has signed on to come and attend a lot of speakers, that'll be in St. Louis at the end of August. So please
watch
that.
What's that summit called?
It's called Gateway to Freedom. And I don't have the exact, I should have the URL here in front of me, but it's Gateway to Freedom in August, late August, like the 26th or 27th, 3 days of military speakers, media presence, physicians, and pediatrics, and also adult conversations.
Fantastic.
So, Gateway to Freedom in the St. Louis area. We're not done yet. We're fighting this, and we are going to win back freedom for our nation 100% because we have no other choice. There is nowhere else to go. We love our nation, and we're not standing down. So, do not comply to any of this. Take a stand at home like you're doing to the listeners, and we're going to get our country back.
Thank you, Dr. Rennie. What a powerful closing statement, folks, and take your power back.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsandscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.